Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we continue rotating through the candidates in the New York City mayoral race, and City Council Speaker Christine Quinn is back with us now. Hi, Speaker Quinn. Thanks
Hi.
For coming back.
Thanks for having me.
And let me start with a few things in the news today. You've proposed an inspector general to oversee the NYPD, but the federal judge hearing a constitutional challenge to stop and frisk says she might require an independent federal monitor to oversee the department. Here's a clip of Mayor Bloomberg yesterday saying that would be much worse.
Look, we think that a monitor would be even more disruptive than an IG. This is just a terrible idea, and it's not needed.
Do you share the mayor's distaste for a court-appointed monitor?
Well, look, I don't know exactly what the confines of a court-appointed monitor would be, so it's a little early for anybody to opine about whether it's good, bad, or indifferent. But the reason the courts are engaged is because stop and frisk was grossly overused. And I believe overused in a way that was far outside of the constitutional bounds of this practice. Now, that's why, separate and apart from whatever the courts do, as a legislator, I'm going to move this bill forward to make sure we have a permanent monitoring mechanism for the NYPD that's separate from the police department so it can really monitor. And when they did this in Los Angeles, because some folks will tell you, oh, you monitor, crime's going to go up. The year after they did it in L.A., crime went down 33% and community satisfaction with the police, and L.A. has had its challenges, 84%. This will keep us the safest big city in America, but heal the wounds of stop and frisk.
Funny enough, that clip I just played was probably the nicest thing Mayor Bloomberg ever said about your inspector general bill.
that is possible.
Federal monitor would be even worse. That's faint praise. If you're the mayor and you're in charge of the NYPD, why not just order them to use stop and frisk in a better way, rather than set up an IG who might muddy the chain of command?
Well, first of all, I will. When I am the mayor, I will make it abundantly clear. I will order the police department to stop abusing stop and frisk, period. To do it, the stops, only when they are constitutionally sound. That will be perfectly clear from me before day one.
So what's the IG's position in relation to you if you're a mayor?
Well, the IG, and of course the IG has really come out in response to stop and frisk, but it's not exclusively about that. I mean, most city agencies have a monitoring entity within the Department of Investigation. Most federal law enforcement have monitoring. You want, given the extreme power of the NYPD, to have somebody looking at its policies and practices from 30,000 feet, if you will, not the individual officers. We have internal affairs for that. This is looking overall and giving the mayor and the police commissioner ideas, suggestions, how to improve the department. I fail to understand why anyone wouldn't want more suggestions. And the chain of command argument, I don't mean to be disrespectful, but it's ridiculous. These are going to be suggestions from the inspector general to the mayor.
Who appoints the IG? Would it be you? It's an independent monitor.
It would be appointed by the mayor in the Department of Investigation.
So how independent is that?
Well, you have to have it appointed in government, right? So the mayor has to be the person who appoints that, but they're not going to report to the police commissioner, and they're going to have subpoena power.
All right. Christine Quinn, my guest. On another news story today, I see that a task force that you and the mayor convened after Sandy is suggesting changes to the building code to make homes and businesses more wind and flood resistant. And you've got city council legislation to implement some of it. Want to talk about what you think is important there?
Yeah, what happened after Hurricane Sandy, the mayor and I put together the Building Resiliency Task Force with all kinds of experts, architects, plumbers, engineers, et cetera, to tell us what did we learn and what do we need to do to make our structures climate change ready. There are many recommendations in these. Some are best practices, some are legislation, and we're going to pass them. Things like in all new buildings and retrofitting in buildings, making sure you have a water supply somewhere on, say, the sixth or seventh floor. Because when the power goes out, gravity, you can't keep getting water. But if you have it on a lower floor, you will be able to continue to get it. Emergency lighting in stairwells. So if your elevator is out, you will be able to go up and down the stairs. Requiring buildings to have real emergency plans that are helped to be developed by the Office of Emergency Management.
These things will cost money. The Real Estate Board of New York is quoted saying they support the changes, but they'll be expensive. So should people expect higher rents, or is that even a way of the Real Estate Board lobbying for future stabilized rent increases?
Well, look, the Real Estate Board of New York, I want to thank them because they were part of the task force, and you want to have the folks who are running buildings at the table so your ideas are real. Some may cost money. Some of that money may come from the federal Sandy relief funds we've gotten. Some will not cost all that much money. If you think about hooking up a water supply centrally in a building, that's not an really expensive plumbing proposition for a building. And what we learned in Sandy and what the Real Estate Board learned in Sandy is you're going to pay now or you're going to pay later if you don't make your building sound. And having the ability, for example, to keep more fuel on site in a building, that doesn't cost you anything. We need to change the law that limits how much fuel you can have.
And still on Life After Sandy, I'm sure you saw the mayor's big climate change resiliency plan released earlier this week, including bulkheads and levees and flood walls, many of them removable, plus a seaport city, building Manhattan out into the East River near the Brooklyn Bridge, kind of like Battery Park City on the west side on the Hudson. And he made a point of proposing all this before he leaves office and urging whoever the next mayor is to follow through. Are you willing to commit to the mayor's whole plan here today?
Well, we're still in the process of reviewing the mayor's whole plan. It's about 468 pages. So I'm not going to commit to every item on 468 pages today. But what I can say is that about 2 weeks after Hurricane Sandy, I came out with a $20 billion initial proposal of what we needed to do to make the city climate change ready. And a central part of that was hardening the exteriors of New York City. And I'm very gratified to see the mayor endorsing that idea. Some of that will be reefs. Some of that will be natural, using park blue belts. Some of that will be man-made seawall. So I think that is absolutely the mayor heading in the right direction.
Is there anything in that plan that's raised a red flag for you so far as something you are kind of skeptical about?
I need to understand more about the Seaport City idea. I need more details on that. My staff and the mayor's staff are, you know, they're giving those to us right now. That's obviously a very bold and big idea, and I want to understand more of it. But I also want to say what's in this plan, and I give the mayor a lot of credit for it, there's still more we need to do and more we've already done. So one of the things that wasn't in this plan was really looking at overhead power lines. But a number of months ago, we in the council passed legislation requiring Con Ed to begin a plan to put overhead power lines underground. In Manhattan, all the power lines are underground. Only 15% of New Yorkers get their power from overhead lines. But during Sandy, 50% of the people without power got power from overhead lines. If we're going to be stronger, that needs to be addressed. We also have 10 pieces of legislation will pass before I leave the speaker's office to deal with caring for the homeless, senior citizens, the most vulnerable during a storm. The mayor's plan was an infrastructure plan, so I just want to make sure people know we're working on other areas as well.
Changing topics, your book is now officially released. The title, With Patience and Fortitude. It's mostly personal. It's not a policy book. Why did you write that kind of book, Time for the Mayoral Campaign?
You know, when I got, and I want to make sure people know, it's named after the New York Public Library Lions, Patience and Fortitude. That's who the book is.
Very
my two
good.
Favorite
Very
New Yorkers.
Very few people know that piece of trivia. Right.
Fiorella LaGuardia named them during the Depression because what New Yorkers needed was patience and fortitude. You know, I got married a little over a year ago, and we tried to keep the wedding fairly private. It ended up getting a lot of press. And in the course of that press, I got a lot of emails and letters that from folks who said they were moved by the wedding. And I got one particular email from a dad who had recently lost his wife, who had a teenage daughter. And in that email, he said, seeing me and my dad, seeing Kim and her dad, Kim's mom passed away when she was a teenager, gave him hope that he and his daughter could get through this. And that email really kind of made me start thinking about when you share the private part of yourselves when you're in a public spotlight, how helpful that can be. So when the opportunity came around to write a book, and given that we're in a, I'm in a certain level of the spotlight at this moment, it seemed to me the right thing to do to use it to hopefully get a message out there that will help people.
So is it just about making a connection, or does it make you more qualified to be mayor that you, you know, the things that are getting the headlines out of your book, that you battled alcoholism and bulimia in your past, or that you finally got to marry your partner?
I don't think it makes me any more qualified to be mayor, and the point of the book wasn't to, or isn't, to kind of detail my qualifications for mayor. That's what the race is about. This book, I hope, was an opportunity, or is an opportunity, for me to share more of what my life's struggle has been in a way that I hope will send a message to people who might be in a similar spot, that when people tell you it gets better and you want to kind of strangle them because it sounds like it can't possibly, it actually does, and I'm living proof of that.
Funny thing is, if you were running for president, the label of first woman president, first gay president, would be dominant. In the context of the mayor's race, it doesn't seem to be. Everyone seems to be more chill about the whole thing. Why do you think that is?
Well, you know, look, this is the most diverse city in America, and we wear our diversity with great pride, as we should. But it's such an ingrained part of our life every day. I think that's why it doesn't seem what it might in a different race. And that's a credit to New York. And it's a credit to how deeply committed we are to equality and diversity.
Or is it a big thing? Do you want to sit here and say, it matters that I would be the first woman mayor of New York or the first lesbian mayor of New York?
You know, from my perspective, it matters that I'll be a great mayor. And it matters that I have a record unparalleled compared to my opponents, that I have passed more pro-tenant legislation than any city council in history, that I got the state legislature to make kindergarten mandatory, that I've passed 7 balanced on-time budgets that kept firehouses open and prevented teacher layoffs. Those are the things that matters, because, look, talk is cheap in a political race. Delivering matters, and that's what I've done, and that's really the conversation I'm having with New Yorkers.
Christine Quinn with us for another few minutes, running for mayor, city council speaker. Presently, Bill de Blasio, the public advocate, was here this week, and he made it clear that he wants to be known as the most progressive candidate in the race. Do you want to battle him for that label?
I want to be known as the most effective candidate in this race, the one who's gotten the most done for New Yorkers. And so, therefore, when I tell a New Yorker, I'll work with you to get more housing for your neighborhood, it's not a promise. It's a statement I know I can deliver on. They know I can deliver on, because I've already brought thousands of affordable housing units.
Does that mean that the liberal conservative spectrum is irrelevant to you?
You know, look, I am very proud of my life's work as a progressive, as a housing and tenant organizer, as a crime victims advocate, as someone who's fought for choice, for LGBT rights, but not just someone who's fought for choice. I've passed legislation in the city council giving more protection to reproductive rights clinics and really shining a light on these fake crisis pregnancy centers. So labels, of course, matter, but delivering matters more. And I don't want to battle for a label. I want to battle to get things done for New York.
I ask partly because you've gotten a reputation among certain progressive groups as, if not the most conservative candidate in the Democratic primary, I don't know if that would be the word, maybe the most establishment candidate. Your reluctance on paid sick leave, your relationship with Mayor Bloomberg and real estate and other business leaders, even your enabling of Mayor Bloomberg's term limits extension 4 years ago, people say maybe the most establishment candidate. Is that a fair or unfair perception in your opinion?
I can't tell you how unfair I think that is. If you look at the record of what I've done, it's been about moving the city forward to make it a better place. And I think bringing 10,000 more pre-kindergarten seats, that's progressive in making more early childhood education. Passing a law where the landlord lobby sued me in court that allows tenants the right to take their landlord to court for tenant harassment, that's not just progressive, it's powerful. I've given, through the work I've done, tenants rights they've never had before and stood up against the real estate industry. But look, Brian, if there's a moment where I can come together with the real estate industry or anybody else and come to an agreement that makes the city better, why on some type of ideological principle would I not do that?
One more issue. Libraries.
Yes.
We're in the budget season right now where the speaker and the mayor hash out a new fiscal year budget by the end of June, the annual dance, and, you know, it's always cuts and restorations to kids and seniors and libraries. This year I'm seeing activists say a $106 million cut on the table for libraries, with 60 out of the 200 neighborhood libraries threatened with closure. Is that a real number? And what can you promise the city's library users today?
You know, I don't know whether that closure number is right and how you would spread out cuts. It may be. I'm not sure. Different systems would.
60 out of 200 branches.
Unthinkable.
That's huge.
Unthinkable. Now, look, libraries are critical to the future of this city. And they used to be places where you just took books out of. And that would be enough, but there's so much more than that now. They're community centers. They're mini city halls. And they have been a top priority for me every year I've been Speaker of the City Council. And when I'm mayor, I want to get us back to full-day, six-day service. And when we have the resources, really get us to seven-day services. We don't lead the country as it relates to library hours, and we need to be a leader in that area. So what I can tell listeners is I'm going to fight and deliver for libraries like I've done every year I've been speaker.
Is that contentious between you and the mayor right now for this budget negotiation?
You know, we're in negotiations. Everything that's on the table is being discussed. Nothing is overly contentious, but nothing has been agreed to yet. But libraries are so critical for New Yorkers, particularly for new New Yorkers, for immigrants, as a place to go to get resources, to be in the community. And, you know, sometimes it's easy to think everybody has a computer at home. They don't. And not every neighborhood has good internet access. Libraries help fill that gap as well.
30 seconds, open mic. Anything you want to say?
You know, I just would like listeners to really go take a look at my record. Again, what being mayor is about is knowing you can deliver for New Yorkers. And I know I can because I have. And if you look at my record compared to everyone else in the race, my opponents, with all due respect, have put out a lot of press releases, pointed a lot of fingers, but none of them, from education to housing to tenants to a woman's right to choose, none of them have delivered the way I have. So I'm not making promises. I'm committing to continue my record.
City Council Speaker Christine Quinn, thank you very much. We'll keep talking.
Stay dry in this weird weather.
And we'll keep talking to mayoral candidates. We have John Liu on Monday. And listeners, in case you're interested, I'll be talking about the mayoral race and other issues as a guest on the New York One Reporters Roundtable tonight around 7:30 and 10:30 on New York One. So maybe some of you will see me there. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, why just recycle when you can upcycle? We'll explain what that means.